You're listening to Exit This Way with Kerry Sauls.
Welcome to Exit This Way, where we discuss planning your exit strategy so you can get out on your terms, on your timeline, because it's never too early or too late to plan your exit. Welcome to the conversation today. This is Kerry Sauls, the Value Growth Exit Strategist and your host on Exit This Way. Today's topic is beginning with the end in mind, preparing now for due diligence later. That's what we're talking about, and here to give us perspective on his lessons learned, I'm joined by Thomas K. Cox, a partner with McCarthy Duffy LLP. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you for having me, Kerry. I appreciate it.
It's a real pleasure to have you, and I really am excited to share this content with our audience. Thank you so much for joining me for Exit This Way. Before we get started, I do want our audience to understand how much value you're bringing to the table and why I so much appreciate you taking the time to join us. Thomas K. Cox is a partner with McCarthy Duffy LLP, a Chicago-based law firm supporting the needs of emerging and growth stage businesses and their investors. He oversees Seneca Health Partners, a healthcare-focused venture capital fund, and serves as a principal with Cascade Partners LLC, an investment banking and private investment firm. At McCarthy Duffy, Mr. Cox works closely with privately held firms in initial organization, structural and shareholder activities, equity incentive plan development and implementation, general corporate, commercial, and real estate activities, supplier relationships, and general regulatory compliance matters, particularly in the healthcare industry. He also supports the legal needs of early stage and middle market firms in connection with equity and debt financing, joint ventures, mergers, acquisitions, and divestitures. Representative clients range from startups licensing novel technologies from universities to multinational private equity-backed businesses. In addition to his legal background, Mr. Cox has served as a CEO and a senior executive with two private equity and venture capital-backed businesses, and he's managed two private investment funds. He has led or participated in over 30 venture and private equity investments as a principal investor over his career. Welcome again, Tom Cox.
Thank you, Kerry. I appreciate it.
Well, you've been on both sides of the table in many different roles, and that's where the insight you bring to the points you're covering today, they're not just theory. This is through the school of hard knocks that you've learned all along the way. So I take what the advice you're giving our listeners very seriously, because it's not just talk, it's from real practice in the real world.
No, it's a fair point. And having been not only involved in transactions as an attorney, but also as an investor, and certainly in one case as a CEO, it's been interesting to see what I would call the evolution of the due diligence process on the part of buyers. And that's really whether the buyer is a strategic buyer or a financial buyer or even an individual looking to get into a business. The amount of time that's spent, for lack of a better word, doing a due diligence proctology exam on your business is extraordinary. And really, the difference between thinking through some of these issues now and putting in place a foundation today as opposed to doing it at the time that your business is being sold or up for sale can really mean a material difference in the value of your business in the hands of a buyer. So that's really where we spend quite a bit of time with clients to help them understand, like, whatever you're doing today, even if it seems like it's painful and unnecessary, it will come out to be valuable at the time of an exit or at the time of the sale of a business.
That is so true, and yet owners, because it's painful for them to start doing so many of these things that they'd never had to do before, doing it any earlier than they absolutely think they need to seems like a waste of time, way, way too proactive and preventative. And yet, as you said, I can't reemphasize it enough, substantial material difference in the value of your business to the buyer, which absolutely brings it back to more leverage for that seller, starting from what you do right now, which I think is to me, very exciting for them to be able to realize.
No, it's a great point, Kerry. And I think the difference between spending energy today putting in place processes, and as I mentioned, I think, to you earlier, thinking through your capital structure and making sure that your capital structure is well documented, and making sure you have basic forms in place and that your human resources activities are well documented will really make the difference between a buyer who is excited and who sees the opportunities going forward versus a buyer who is now thinking about, boy, what landmines am I going to deal with in this business? So it's it really does change the tenor of the negotiations and a tenor of the process, depending upon how much energy and effort, as you've said, the entrepreneur or the business owner puts into those activities today.
It is huge. Let's start with one of those, because corporate record keeping, owners, they set up their business or they went to LegalZoom to set up their business, which I know to attorneys, I mean, they cringe when I mention that company.
No, not at all. In fact, we encourage people to do as many things on their own as makes sense to do. And I can't say that I'm a huge advocate of LegalZoom, but I think there's certainly a place for them in certain activities. But one of the things that we do see, and again, we counsel clients on relative to thinking about the activities today, is documenting decisions. So a corporation that decides to either issue equity or to enter into a substantial loan agreement or to take steps with respect to a key supplier or customer, the more those things are documented and the more the documentation reflects the fact that the company has actually thought through this and made a conscious effort to the point of putting in place a simple resolution or adopting minutes that describe the decisions. Again, the more easy it will be for a buyer to put together the jigsaw puzzle of the pieces of the history of the business. So I think from a general corporate record-keeping perspective, what you will find is that many small businesses think to themselves, well, it's okay, I'm the decision maker here, especially if it's a single owner business, and I don't really have to justify that to anyone. Again, from the standpoint of thinking about what due diligence that a buyer might do, the first question that comes up is, show me your corporate minute book. If you don't have that, I have worked with clients who have actually had to try to recreate several years of minutes in the space of a few days to anticipate a due diligence request from a buyer.
I have heard that story many, many times, and sellers are always surprised, A, that it's going to be asked, and B, that the buyer is looking for you to easily be able to deliver that in days, not weeks or months.
Well, and the other thing, too, is that many buyers, depending upon, obviously, the size of the business, the buyer will certainly put up some of his or her or its own capital. But in many cases, the capital to support the acquisition will be coming from a third party. Might be a third party investor, might be a bank. Those entities themselves will want to make sure that the buyer is checking off all the boxes. So even if the buyer feels comfortable that the corporate records are, albeit less than perfect, are okay, they will have to support an investment or a lending decision by virtue of showing to their capital sources the fact that they have made the effort to go through and really scrutinize the books and records of the company.
So it's not just for the one person you're trying to negotiate with on the other side of the table, but it's everyone around them who expects to see this standard, this level of information being complete, up to date, and accurate.
No, that's exactly right, Carrie. And if you think about, you know, back in the good old days, which in some respects have returned, the good old fashioned leverage buyout, which is where a buyer puts up a small portion of the equity of the business, backed by a lender or multiple lenders who are providing the rest of the capital in the form of debt, the buyer has had to go through a similar type of analysis and is similarly being due diligenced, if you will, by that lender or those investors. So, yeah, I think your point's very well taken.
But that brings up another piece that's so important with all of this, is tracking your corporate, your capital structure that you alluded to before. You said it needs to be well documented, but that's only a one-liner. Can you expound on that for our listeners of what that really entails because of what due diligence will be expected?
Sure, sure. And particularly in the context of a buyer who is now thinking about who actually are the sellers and what sellers are going to receive what value from this exit transaction. So as I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with, Kerry, there are a number of companies who take the very wise and highly supportable position that it's appropriate to provide equity or equity incentives to certain employees or certain key executives or certain team members in order to get them thinking like owners and get them to focus on the same sets of goals as the primary owner. And I can't tell you the number of times that I've talked to clients, particularly clients who are running hard and running fast, which I'm sure many of your listeners are, who say, yeah, I promised so-and-so that they would get some options, and I didn't really write it down, but they should really get something. And this person, I gave them a napkin that said, you're going to get 3% of the business no matter what happens, and so they're entitled to X, Y, and Z. And what ends up happening is, in situations like that, the first thing that will occur in a exit transaction, and Kerry, I know you've seen this many times, is that there is a contract between the buyer and seller, a purchase and sale agreement. Could be an equity purchase or an asset purchase. But one of the representations that the seller is always required to make is the seller, or attached as exhibit whatever, is a list of all of the owners of the business. And there is nobody else who owns any part of the business. And sellers who can't do that or can't do that with a straight face, A, will cause significant disruption to the transaction, and B, may cause themselves liability. I met with a small client, I guess about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and they're two partners, and they'd been in business together for a long time, and I had met them early on, and I said, well, tell me, you know, do you two own the business together? And they quickly said yes, and then there was a pregnant pause, and one of them said, well, no. There's another guy that we think maybe owns 5% of the business, but we can't really find him and contact him, and we're not really sure about how that's been done. So you think now, put yourself in the shoes of a buyer, and you're buying what you believe to be all of the equity from these two principals and these two partners, and suddenly out of the woodwork, sometime after the acquisition closes, comes this third individual who says, hey, I want my money too. Think about the amount of disruption and, candidly, the amount of litigation that will incur if you don't really know who owns your business and who is part of your capital structure. It's a very easy issue to gloss over, especially when you have a business that is growing rapidly or going through significant change. It's very easy to go to somebody and say, I promise you, you'll get equity. I'll take care of you, without actually documenting it. And the lack of documentation is what comes back to haunt the buyer, or the seller, I should say, when the buyer starts asking around and ultimately puts a number of significant and serious clauses into the purchase and sale contract.
Those are huge points that cannot be minimized, because it does come back to haunt everyone. But at the same time, these aren't hard things to produce. This is just a statement in your minutes or a resolution that simply says, I said I would take care of so-and-so, that means X, and you document it. And you've just documented with information about who they are, and that's it. It doesn't have to be another 5-page document that your lawyer has to create for you.
No, and back to your comment about LegalZoom, the forms used to provide somebody an option or a warrant or anything like that, an incentive to participate in the equity of a business, are very straightforward. And we have piles of forms that take matters of minutes to produce for a client or for a business who wants to extend, again, an equity offering to an employee or to a board member or to an executive. So it isn't hard. It's not expensive. It does take a little bit of time, and it takes some thought about what is it that I'm trying to accomplish by giving equity to the warehouse personnel or to the receptionist or switchboard operator, if people use switchboards anymore. What is the value of doing that? But once it's done, the process of documenting those things, to your point, Carrie, is very simple and really quite inexpensive. And again, the old, you can either pay me now or pay me later. The cost of negotiating and correcting those things down the road, particularly at the point of a sale of the business, is quite a bit more than the cost of correcting it and doing it right today.
And also, not just the cost, but the risk. And I'm emphasizing that just because of a conversation I had today with a client about an employee could end up breaking the deal because of that kind of a contract not being clearly in place.
Sure.
You don't want your deal to be killed because an employee thinks that they've got you handcuffed.
It's an excellent point, and unfortunately it does happen. If you don't have a situation where an employee doesn't feel like they're bound by the same rules, one of the issues that comes up often is particularly in businesses that have any sort of proprietary relationship with the market or proprietary information or anything that amounts to a trade secret, if an employee isn't obligated to maintain those secrets or isn't obligated by virtue of being an owner to maintain some level of loyalty to the company that's being sold, the buyer now looks and says, the value that I am buying is potentially capable of partly walking out the door and going down the street and starting up their own business or divulging the names of the customers and the suppliers and the other things that make this business special. So it's another sort of general area apart from the issues of equity is making sure that when employees join a company, particularly if it's a company that has some unique niche in the marketplace by virtue of some level of, again, proprietary or secret sauce, if you will, in the industry in which they compete, is saying to those people, look, in exchange for you coming to work for me and having the opportunity to be an employee, I'd like you to agree that you will keep these things secret. Without that, without having those people signed up that way, and again, simple forms, not difficult to do, the risk is that your buyer, the buyer of your business, is going to see a potential damage occurring to your asset once it's sold. And therefore, again, the worst case of all worst case scenarios is they will reduce the value of your business and reduce the purchase price.
Exactly. Because once you reduce the value of the asset, that also ripples down to the number of multiples that you can negotiate on that lower value, which
Definitely.
Drastically reduces what you walk away with. And if that's preventable, that's what we want to do, as you're talking about, beginning with the end in mind. Prepare now for these things so that when you do go through that due diligence later, and it's not optional whether you go through due diligence when you're going through a transaction, it will happen. That's unavoidable. So why not minimize the risks on your side of the table as early as possible? Get them off your plate.
And part of what you also do, I think, by taking those steps, a lot of what is the overarching message, I think, of what we're chatting about is putting in place processes. And processes is, in some respects, a fancy word of having good form documents and ultimately using them in a regular and consistent way. The more you do that, the more your buyer is going to look at this business as something closer to turnkey. So a truly exciting, valuable business is obviously one that's growing and one that's doing well, but one that requires less, for lack of a better word, carry cleanup, and one that requires less energy to correct mistakes that were made in the past. The more of that you have to do as a buyer, the more, again, you're going to discount the value of that business and the value of that asset going forward. We talk a little bit about shareholder agreements and the art of making sure that shareholders will go along. So one of the things that we often do with earlier stage companies is we strongly urge the shareholders to agree amongst themselves that they will not sell their shares to third parties, and if a majority or a supermajority of the shareholders elects to do something, then the minority of shareholders has to go along with. So think about the dynamic now of you're a business owner, you have 10 partners. You have reached an agreement with a buyer to sell your business, and 8 of your partners are thrilled about this, but 2 of them say, this is my chance to hold up the deal for something extra. Without those shareholder relationships in place up front, you're now in a situation where you have to not only negotiate with the buyer, but also negotiate with your former partners, again, which makes for lots of complexity, and the only ones who win in those situations are, unfortunately, the lawyers.
That's right. It is the lawyers. I'm a strong advocate that all of these kinds of agreements and understandings get made up front when everybody is happy going in, when you're still on that the high of starting and growing the business successfully, that you don't anticipate any of these kinds of disagreements ever occurring, but therefore put them down if something were to happen, if this kind of situation occurred or an opportunity occurred, you've laid out how things are going to run because everybody was in agreement and signed it early. I couldn't agree more. It's something I advocate all the time with owners. Even if we haven't started working together, I'm checking to see if these kinds of documents, these structures are in place, because that's a strong safety net and foundation for anything that can come their way.
Sure. Sure. No, I think it's a great point. And to your point, it's much easier to agree when people are agreeable. And to be able to define these types of relationships early on in the process before those relationships are tested in the heat of a negotiation or, again, in the heat of due diligence around an acquisition is extremely helpful. I think you're exactly right.
In a negotiation, everyone's going to be for themselves, and suddenly you don't, as you said, you don't have two sides. You have multiple negotiations that are going on concurrently, and that right there can wear everybody out. Never mind take longer and the buyer starts getting cold feet because it's not moving quick enough. So
correct.
You risk the deal itself.
Yep. It's a great point. We recently were involved in the sale of a client, reasonably large client, to a strategic buyer. And at one point, the buyer, in the course of their due diligence, discovered that there was an errant license agreement out to a third party that had not been exercised but was still exercisable. So the buyer forced the seller, our client, to go back and now renegotiate the terms of a license agreement with this third party, even though they had no particular incentive to do so, and at this point had no knowledge of the transaction, obviously. So the amount of additional effort and energy that goes into those types of discussions is, as you said, can be extremely time-consuming, extremely expensive, and ultimately cost you certainly a fair amount of inertia going along with what could otherwise be a positive transaction.
I agree. I want to move on in the interest of time. The other piece that you alluded to earlier was commercial contracts and other forms. What should be in some of these contracts if you're trying to be better prepared for due diligence, not just for the contract negotiation in the moment with a client, a service provider, a vendor, whatever, but what should be in there in anticipation down the road of a potential transaction?
Yeah, great question. And probably two big things. And these are commercial contracts, can be with customers, can be with partners, can be with vendors.
Right.
Anyone with whom a long-term relationship is important. Yeah, two things. One is that notion of confidentiality. So making sure that when you have a relationship with a third party or a commercial partner and the parties are sharing information, that information is subject to very basic confidentiality and non-disclosure provisions. And I think it's important in almost every contract that one can see with a business that those types of protections be part of that contract. And again, they're not complicated clauses. There are boilerplate provisions that you can probably get online. LegalZoom may even have them. But in any event, it's not difficult typically to incorporate those into those types of contracts. And the other thing, Carrie, that actually ends up being an interesting dynamic, we recently were involved in another transaction selling a client where we spent, I think, 2 weeks of an attorney's full time going through contracts to determine whether or not the sale of the business would result in a termination of the agreement. And so at the bottom of every contract, and I'm sure your clients and listeners know this, is a whole set of standard boilerplate miscellaneous provisions, one of which has to do with assignment. And I work at least as much as I can to train our clients and my clients to say, look, the assignment provision is sort of a throwaway clause, but do me a favor, add a sentence to it that says, notwithstanding the foregoing, the famous notwithstanding clause, this contract can be assigned by the seller, that your company, your client, to any party who buys all or substantially all of the assets or equity of the business. So what does that mean? That means if you are a buyer and you are looking at a company that has as part of its value a whole slew of agreements with third parties, could be customer contracts, could be research contracts, could be development contracts, could be government contracts, that now you know that if you buy this business, that purchase, that change of control will not result in the right or give the other party the right to terminate that contract. And the amount of times we've spent talking through and listing and scheduling, well, here's a set of contracts that could be triggered or a termination could be triggered by virtue of this transaction, is enormous. It comes up quite a bit in leases. So most leases will have a provision, a standard, and most leases are largely boilerplate as it is, but many of them have a provision that says, in the event that the tenant changes control or there is a new owner of the tenant, then the landlord has the right to terminate, or the landlord has the right to extract this, that, or the other financial concession. And if you think about what that does, so you now have a buyer who says, wow, if I close this deal, do I have to move the company? Do I have to renegotiate the lease? I mean, we've had transactions that have slowed by a period of weeks, if not months, waiting for our client to finalize negotiations on a lease to allow them to actually sell the business. So those are probably the two big things that would go into what I would call commercial contracts, Carrie. Just thinking more about making sure that any information that you disclose that you want to keep secret is in fact covered by a confidentiality clause, and giving yourself the right to assign the contract to somebody who buys the business.
Huge points, huge. But when we're talking about due diligence, is there anything we need to be, you talked about earlier that the human resources documents need to be in place, but what else do we need to be concerned about when it comes to employee and human resources if we're trying to prepare early for due diligence later?
You know, a couple things. I think we did talk about confidentiality, and it's always good to have new employees, really of any level or any position in the organization, agree to keep confidential information confidential, to not disclose that to third parties. It's often a good practice, and again, certainly a standard form that many of our clients use, and I would certainly recommend to your listeners as well, to agree or to have new employees agree that if they leave the company, they won't solicit, these are called non-solicitation clauses, not surprisingly, they won't solicit either other employees or customers. So people come and go from companies all the time, and sometimes in a positive way and sometimes in a less positive way. Nothing hurts a business more than to have an employee leave the company and either attempt to take other valuable employees with him or her to their new employer or to go out and market to the company's customers. And so having a general And it doesn't have to be incredibly onerous. It can be, for instance, for a year after they leave the company, but having a non-solicitation provision in the course of a basic employment relationship or employment agreement that new employees sign is not a bad idea. And then the third thing, again, and this may vary depending upon the nature of the business, but we often suggest that as part of this human resources catch-all provision, you know, sort of the onboarding of new employees, if you will, that those employees also agree that if they invent something or if they discover something or if they identify some new way of doing business that ends up being valuable to the company, that they agree that they will assign that invention or that discovery or that new way of business, of doing business, they will transfer that over to the employer. So again, if you think about, in some cases, a business where part of what they are doing is selling a unique product that they have spent time and energy and effort developing, or a unique chemical or a unique compound of some sort, what you want your new employees to do is to agree that if they work on that product, and as a result of that work, they come up with an improvement, something that makes that product better for the marketplace, that work is owned by the company. So again, if you think about now, the buyer of the business knows that, okay, everything that this company has done for the past 5 years, 10 years, whatever the case may be, everything that their employees have done is clearly owned by the company and is subject to the company's right to transfer that information or that ownership. That's a very positive tool, and again, that will help certainly from a standpoint of giving comfort to your buyer in the course of due diligence.
And those are things that you need to keep in mind from the first day that you engage any employee to protect the company in its current state and its value today, positioning you for any future opportunities. But those are pieces that you really should have in place regardless of when or if you want to sell the business. They're just protecting you as the owner of the business.
It's a great point. And you're right. And I think some of these comments are geared toward thinking about, as we said, the end, beginning with the end in mind and thinking about what you're going to present to a prospective buyer and how you're going to explain and disclose and describe your business. But, Carrie, you're exactly right. These are just good business practices as well.
I agree. One more point just before we have to close out. You alluded to what an employee could create or add value. How does that overlap into the intellectual property of the company or protecting the intellectual property of the company or then being able to transfer that to a new owner, or do you have to transfer all the IP to a new owner?
Good question, and I would say in most cases, if your listener or your clients are selling their business, they are typically transferring the intellectual property associated with that business. In some situations, you may have a case where a business has in-licensed certain technology and what it is transferring to a new owner is a license or the license to that technology. But in many cases, it's the rights to any of their products and services. And what you will find is when a buyer or even a sophisticated buyer starts looking at the nature of the products or even in some cases the services that a company is offering in the marketplace and is evaluating those, what you'll find is that they will look closely at the extent to which the company has assignment provisions and invention assignment provisions built into their employment contracts. So in most cases, the seller is selling all of the intellectual property that they have, and ideally what you want to make sure is that the buyer can take away from their due diligence and their conversations the comfort that they are getting into. They're acquiring a business or acquiring an asset or a service that has all of the right to do what they want to do, and that fundamentally there's nobody else who has the right to practice those inventions if it's a patentable invention or to disclose those inventions if it's a trade secret to any third party.
Well, we are out of time. Tom Cox, I would love to have you back on Exit This Way. There's so much more we need to talk about. But thank you very much for joining me, Tom Cox, on Exit This Way. My last question is to ask, how can our listeners follow up on everything you shared? What's the best way for them to learn more or reach you directly?
Carrie, thank you. It's been a pleasure being on the program. My phone number is 847-702-7896, and that is actually my cell number, which my office number is also primarily forwarded into. So as we tell people, we doze but never close. My email address is tcox@mccarthyduffy.com.
We doze but never close. That's great, Tom. And thank you, listeners, for joining me for Exit This Way today. Exit This Way is presented by This Way Out Group, exit strategists helping you maximize value so you can harvest the wealth in your business. Enjoy our extensive library of past shows by going to thiswayoutgroup.com under the Exit Planning Resource tab, or you can join us on iTunes. In the iTunes store, look for Exit This Way. This is Carrie Sauls, your host on Exit This Way. Tune in next time. ¶¶